Well, I won't say every other situation, but in a lot of situations, you can hardly tell there's anything really wrong with me. I just have basically too much personality for one person and not quite enough for two. But in the area of romance, boom, you know right away. When I was little, about 7, I guess, I remember getting in the car with my mother when she picked me up from school and telling her I had seen the word fuck written on the handball court at the playground, and I wanted to know what it meant. And she said, "I'll have to tell you later, dear, when I can draw you diagrams." Well, needless to say, later never came, and neither did, I'm sorry to report, those promised diagrams. Which is a shame, really, because I think they would have come in pretty handy from time to time. Armed with my mother's diagrams, I might have moved through the world of dating in smooth, easy motions, like a queen, with that straight-back certainty that comes with being entitled, cared for, and wearing crowns. But without those diagrams, I shuffle around like some street person, clumsy and stooped, with the carriage of someone who picks through the trash, shopping for dinner. But let's face it, the world of sex is weird no matter how you look at it. I mean, 14 hours after you've had your face smashed into someone's genitals, you're walking down the street with them as though that were all just fine. Thank you. How are you? The first crush I ever had was on a boy called Willie Breton. For some reason, my friends and I used to say his name without using our tongues, which, for whatever reason, was highly enjoyable. I can't recommend it as an activity highly enough. Feel free to try it when you're really bored. Anyway, as it happens, Willie is now an Orthodox rabbi living in Israel with his wife and 10 children. How often have I wistfully thought to myself, if I played my carnal cards right, that could have been me. Actually, never. Many years later, when I was in Jerusalem on my honeymoon with Paul, we met up with Willie, now Rabbi Willie, and his wife for lunch. Willie and Paul fought ceaselessly, largely about the deportation of the Arabs from the West Bank. Rabbi Willie for, Rabbi Paul against. I never realized how fun it could be to get a current partner and a past partner together and then pit them against each other. I mean, if you can't really find a good book to read. Ultimately, Paul and I went our separate ways. He went on to marry someone much younger than himself, 25 years, and from the South, Edie Brickell, and so, not to be outdone, I found myself a mate younger than myself. 4 years, and also from the South, Brian Lord. The only difference between our choices, well, his was a girl, mine was a boy, my choice forgot to tell me that he was gay. Well, he forgot to tell me and I forgot to notice. Hey, you know, it could happen. You know when you're first in love and you're grinning at each other like goofballs all the time and making out? Everything just looks better when you're infatuated, doesn't it? Like it's lit from within, and you're telling each other everything, like, I'm a Libra, I like fireflies on a summer night, I like long moonlit walks on the beach on acid. Oh, did I forget to tell you I was gay? I should have had a V8. Actually, he told me later that I had turned him gay. By taking codeine again. And I said, you know, I never read that warning on the label. I thought it said heavy machinery, not homosexuality. Turns out I could have been driving those tractors all along. Turning people gay is kind of a superpower of mine. It's not called upon a lot, but when it is, I pick up my little pink phone, I put on my rainbow-colored cape, and I'm there like a shot. You know, I was probably turning people gay for a long, long, long time, you know, without knowing it, because I took a lot of codeine. And I traveled. So, there are probably pockets of homosexual communities all over the world started by me. You may have seen some of my handiwork. My doctor told me that codeine stays in your liver for 7 years. I mean, unless you have a good lawyer. Well, I don't. I do not have a good lawyer, so what I'm trying to say is there's probably some codeine still left in my liver. So, if you find yourself on your knees in front of someone of the same sex, nude, and that's not where you usually hang out, happy Hanukkah from all of us at Wishful Drinking. Brisk as a bullet shot through the center of everything. I was probably rebounding from Paul when I met Brian a week later, but Brian is really, really attractive. Well, when I met him, he had hair. I do that, too. I make them bald, I turn them gay, my work is done. But Brian took really, really good care of me, and this was really the first time that a man had ever done that. You know, my father left when I was 2. Oh, poor sad Carrie. And Paul and I were the 2 flower things, so this was the first time a man had ever taken care of me. I mean, he used to give me baths like I was a Labrador. Brian took such good care of me, I thought, this guy will make a good father. And I was right. He made a great father. And he still does. So, fearing now that finally everything would be all right, 9 months later, our daughter was dragged from my body as though it were a burning building. And once this well-fed, round creature was rescued from the rubble of me, I sent out a birth announcement, which read, "Someone's summered in my stomach, someone's fallen through my legs. To make an infant omelet, simply scramble sperm and eggs." So Brian and I named our adorable little omelet Billy Catherine Lord. So, a year later, when Brian left me for Scott, well, naturally, I was devastated. I love Brian, and I really like those baths. But my mother was fantastic to me during this time. I mean, my mother, she's like a mother to me, you know? And she said this great thing. She said, "You know, dear, we've had all sorts of men in our family. We've had horse thieves and alcoholics and one-man bands. But this is our first homosexual." Anyway, having nothing to do with Brian, about a year after that, I was invited to go to a mental hospital. And, you know, you don't want to be rude, so you go. Okay, I know what you must be thinking, but this is a very exclusive invitation. I mean, hello, have you ever been invited to a mental hospital? So you see, it's very exclusive. It's sort of like an invitation to the White House, only you meet a better class of people in the mental hospital. My diagnosis was manic depression. I think today they call it bipolar. So you might say I swing both ways. But unless you said it really, really loud, I probably wouldn't hear you. Oh, before I forget, my mother wants you all to know that this comes from my father's side of the family. She is as normal as the day is long. But imagine this, though. Imagine having a mood system that functions essentially like weather, you know, so independently of whatever's going on in your life. So the facts of your life stay the same. Just the emotional fiction that you're responding to differs. It's like I'm not properly insulated. So all the bad and the good ways that you and most of the people in the adjacent neighborhoods and around the world feel, that pours directly into my system unchecked. It is so fun. I call it getting on my grid, or ESP, Egregious Sensory Protection. But ultimately, I feel that I'm very sane about how crazy I am. But periodically, I do explode. Now, the good news about this is that over time, the explosions have gotten smaller and the recovery time is faster. But what is guaranteed is that I will explode. So what I do, because I'm a good hostess, except for the Greg thing, I provide my guests with bibs so that they don't get my crazy juice all over their nice clothes. You know how most illnesses have symptoms you can recognize, right? Like fever, upset stomach, chills, whatever. Well, with manic depression, it's sexual promiscuity, excessive spending, and substance abuse. That just sounds like a terrific weekend in Vegas to me. Oh, this will impress you. I am actually in the abnormal psychology textbook. Obviously, my family's so proud. Keep in mind now, I'm a Pez dispenser, and I'm in the abnormal psychology textbook. Who says you can't have it all? But when I was told about the textbook, I was told I was in there with a photo. And I said, huh? What photo? I mean, it's not like anyone ever called me and said, you know, have you got a little snapshot of yourself looking depressed or manic? You know, like from my show. So for years I wondered, what picture? Well, I have excellent news. Recently I found the picture, and it's a picture of me as Princess Leia. See, so I'm not crazy. That bitch is. Anyone that would wear a hairstyle like that has to be nuts, right? Having received word at an early age that the rest of my life was going to be challenging, at least at very odd intervals, I started seeing a shrink when I was 15. The first was recommended to me by my friend Joan Hackett, and he was a psychologist and not a psychiatrist. Psychiatrists are medical doctors as well as the rest of the psycho stuff. So they're better trained to diagnose mental illness and, oh, so much more importantly, prescribe medication for it. In any case, so to speak, this doctor failed to diagnose my manic depression. Though one day, after I'd been seeing him for many years, he suddenly asked if I'd been hyperactive as a child. Yeah, right. And I just somehow forgot to mention a little thing like that. I mean, it wasn't as if I had an endless supply of life struggles to discuss with him at that point. Although, surely adolescence is a struggle in and of itself, but not so much so that I'd somehow forgotten to mention my hyperactivity. But I think that my first doctor saw something in me that was amiss, but as to what that something was, for the moment, would remain a mystery. My second doc knew exactly what was up with me. Though generally it's useless to diagnose someone as bipolar who's engaged in ingesting large quantities of drugs or alcohol, which I was, because drug addiction and alcoholism, done properly, of course, classically mimics the symptoms of manic depression. So when I was 24 years old, Dr. Barry Stone told me that it was his utterly professional opinion that I was hypomanic, also known as bipolar 1, which is the lesser version of manic depression. Excessively moody as opposed to bipolar 2, excruciatingly moody, which includes the occasional hallucination and lockup ward visits. As it turns out, I was ultimately determined to be the latter, excruciatingly moody. But from where old Doc Stone sat, at this point, I was simply excessively moody. Hey, maybe the whole show hadn't kicked in yet. Or, better still, maybe the drugs were suppressing my symptoms to a certain extent. I mean, that's at least in part why I ingested chemical waste. It was a kind of desire to abbreviate myself, to present the cliff notes of the emotional me as opposed to the 12-volume read. I used to refer to my drug use as putting the monster in the box. I wanted to be less, so I took more. Simple as that. Anyway, I eventually decided that the reason that Dr. Stone had told me that I was hypomanic was that he wanted to put me on medication instead of actually treating me. So I did the only rational thing I could do in the face of such an insult. I stopped talking to Stone, flew back to New York, and married Paul Simon a week later. Jump cut to 2 years after that, and you'll find me overdosing. Not that that was my intention by any means. That was simply the amount of drugs that had become necessary for me to take to get where I wanted to go. My destination being simply anywhere but here. But somehow, en route to that numb place, I'd overshot my mark and almost arrived at nowhere but dead. Well, after that happened, I was quite naturally upset and terrified. I had in no way intended to risk my life. I just wanted to turn the sound down and smooth all of my sharp corners. Block out the dreadfully noisy din of not being good enough, which, on occasion, I was actually able to do. But how had I almost managed to end up at the destination of dead when that was never the direction I originally set off in? It's as if I tripped and almost fell into my own grave. My only intent was to feel better, which is to say not to feel at all. So, based on the fact that my best thinking got me in an emergency room with a tube down my throat, I had no trouble at all accepting the fact that I was an alcoholic. Not that I drank much, you might say I took pills alcoholically. Anyway, I didn't have any difficulty accepting the notion that my life had become unmanageable. I mean, let's face it, my most creative achievement at that time was having unnecessary gum surgery just for the morphine. I don't think you can actually use the word just and morphine anywhere near each other. So I threw myself into 12-step group recovery, believing now that alcoholism was the headline and the overriding thing wrong with me, which was, of course, in large part true and remains true to this day. Because I have to admit, well, I don't have to, but periodically I have had drug slips. All in, I've had 4 slips since I started going to 12-step support groups at the age of 28. Making that 4 slips in 23 years, which is not great. I mean, I'm not proud that I wasn't able to remain sober that entire time, especially in terms of my daughter, who's had to suffer the most from these largely inexcusable forays back down the dark path that is drug use. The most painful thing about returning to this grim planet is seeing the look of disappointment and hurt that these forays invariably put in the eyes of your loved ones. But ultimately, you could say that I don't have a problem with drugs so much as I have a problem with sobriety. And it wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous that failed me. It's that I have, on occasion, failed them by not working what they call a good program. But I keep going back. I'm as addicted to all things AA has to offer as I am to the things that made me need those groups in the first place. But when I first got to 12-step land after my stomach pumping incident, I thought, okay, fine then. This is what's the matter with me. I'm not going to shrinks anymore. My best shrinking and thinking got me into emergency rooms all over Southern California. So, I planned to be an all-meeting, all-the-time gal. Psychiatrists were a thing of the past. Why, they hadn't even told me I was an alcoholic. So screw them. Especially the doctor who tried to convince me that I was hypomanic. Fat lot he knew. Well, as it turned out, what he knew was an extremely fat lot after all. Because over the next year of getting and staying clean and sober, all the people I'd come into the program with were calming down and leveling out, while I seemed to be doing just the opposite. Quick to excite, to agitate, to engage, to anger, I was heading straight up into the rafters of my overly good or bad time. In short, okay, fine, yes, I know it's far too late for that, I was manic. The monster was out of the box, the cat was out of the bag, and it appeared that after a year of erratic sobriety, that I was en route back to the shrinks and psychopharmacologists I had imagined myself not needing anymore. Without the substances I had used to distort and mask my symptoms, it was now all too clear that I was a bona fide wild-ride manic depressive. And this initially dismaying discovery led me to my third and best shrink, Beatrice Foster, who turned out to be the psychiatrist who finally got me to address my manic depression. And I ultimately not only addressed it, I name my two moods Roy and Pam. Roy is rollicking Roy, the wild ride of a mood, and Pam is sediment Pam, who stands on the shore and sobs. Pam stands for piss and moan. One mood is the meal, the next mood, the check. There are a couple reasons why I take comfort in being able to put all this in my own vernacular and present it to you. For one thing, because then I'm not completely alone with it. And for another, it gives me a sense of being in control of the craziness. Now, this is a delusion. But it's my delusion, and I'm sticking with it. It's sort of like I have problems, but problems don't have me. Statistics say that a range of mental disorders affect more than 1 in 4 Americans in any given year. That means millions and millions of people are totally batshit. But having perused the various tests available that they use to determine whether you're manic depressive, OCD, schizoaffective, schizophrenic, or whatever, I'm surprised the number's that low. So I've gone through a bunch of available tests, and I've taken questions from each of them and assembled my own psychological evaluation screen, which I thought I'd share with all of you. So here are some of the things they ask to determine if you're mentally disordered. If you say yes to any number of these questions, you too could be insane. 1. In the last week, have you been feeling irritable? 2. In the last week, have you gained a little weight? 3. In the last week, have you not always felt like talking to people? 4. Do you no longer get as much pleasure out of doing certain things as you used to? 5. In the last week, have you felt fatigued? 6. Do you think about sex a lot? If you don't say yes to any of these questions, either you're a big liar, or you don't speak English, or you're illiterate, in which case I have the distinct impression I may have lost you quite a few chapters ago. An altered, faltering self. Now, come back with me to when I was first told that I was an alcoholic, which greatly relieved me, by the way, because I knew something was the matter with me. So I thought, well, great. That's what it is. That's what I've been struggling with and enjoying all this time. Fantastic. But what they further do to, I think, you know, soften the blow of this arguably awkward new way of looking at yourself, they enumerate a number of other famous and accomplished folks who have also struggled with and enjoyed alcoholism. So, for example, there was Scott Fitzgerald, Mel Gibson, Dylan Thomas, Ireland, Rush Limbaugh, Lindsay Lohan, Russia, and George W. Bush. I think their point is, don't feel bad. You're joining an illustrious group. Great people have been alcoholics. Oh, be one, it's fun. Now, I don't think they're implying that, you know, we could all be great, but these people weren't exactly losers, except probably to some members of their family and all their constituents. So relax and join the great drunks who staggered the earth before you. So when I was told I was a manic depressive, there was a whole other list waiting for me. There was Abraham Lincoln, who wrote the Gettysburg Address in 4 hours. Now that's pretty manic. Winston Churchill, who called his depressed mood the black dog. Korea, Christy McNichol and Sir Isaac Newton, who I think would have made an adorable couple. Mark Twain, St. Francis, St. Teresa, Jonathan Winters, poor Britney Spears, and George W. Bush. Well, naturally, after this list, I felt invigorated. But then, that is part of my diagnosis. So, to celebrate my newfound ascent into the lofty heights of this noble group, I thought I would inaugurate a bipolar pride day. You know, with floats and parades and stuff. On the floats, we would get the depressives. They wouldn't even have to leave their beds. We'd just roll their beds out of their houses, and they could continue staring miserably into space. Then, for the manics, we'd have the manic marching band, with the manics laughing and talking and shopping and fucking and making bad judgment calls. Of course, all this is still in the early planning stages, and knowing manics, it probably always will be. But the point is, we have a plan, and that's what counts. Because when you're manic, every urge is like an edict from the Vatican. No plan is a bad one, because if you're there and you're doing it, can't be bad. It's like a bank error in your favor. Mania is, in effect, liquid confidence. When the tide comes in, it's all good. But when the tide goes out, the mood that cannot and should not be named comes over you and into you. Because to name it would be an act of summoning. Losing your mind is frightening, especially if you have a lot to lose. But once it's lost, it's fine. Absolutely no big deal. You could have a light shining out of your head. It's sort of like glowing in your own dark. Part of my story, because God forbid you miss a minute of it, I stayed awake for 6 days. Now, this happened because two of my medications were interacting badly, so the doctors put me on what they called a medication vacation. There is no Club Med, and you can't send any cute little postcards. Now, anyone who has stayed awake for 6 days knows that there's every chance that they'll wind up psychotic. Anyway, I did. And part of how that manifested itself was that I thought everything on television was about me. Now, if anything like this should happen to you, I have some excellent advice. Don't watch CNN. Please, watch one of those pet training shows or cooking show. Even some of the Discovery shows are fine. But I watched CNN, and at the time, Versace had just been killed by that man Cunanan, and the police were frantically scouring the eastern seaboard for Cunanan. So I was Cunanan, Versace, and the police. Now this is exhausting programming. But by the time I got to be Versace, he was dead. And also, by then, I was in the real hospital part of Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, and I could literally hear the nurses outside my door saying, "Don't listen to her, she's crazy." My brother eventually arrived, and he had to call the mental hospital to see about getting me in, because there was, as my friend Dave says, no room at the bin. You had to be seriously nuts to qualify for residence in the lockdown ward. So, finally, the head doctor of the facility came over. This guy looked like this kind of weird John Steinbeck character, with his abnormally high pants and his strangely neat hair and his trimmed just-so beard. Anyway, he walks in, and I say, "Finally, here's someone who can tell us what it's like to get his cock sucked." Because, as you might have noticed, I had begun swearing a lot, and apparently I couldn't stop. Something in me had become unleashed, and taming it was not imminent. Anyway, this was my audition for the locked ward, and as you probably guessed by now, I passed! I made it into the mental hospital! Hooray! When you qualify for the mental hospital, you have to sign yourself in, you know, like commitment papers, I guess. But I was so far gone, I didn't know what I was signing or doing, and so when they finally put the papers in front of me, I took the pen and signed with my left hand, "Shame." That's how I signed in for the mental hospital. How sad is that? Oh, and my form of mental illness is also a tiny, tiny bit infectious, by the way. I may have gotten it from Amy Winehouse's toilet seat. So by the end of this book, you could be gay and insane, unless you began that way. Anyway, ever since my fateful announcement on Diane Sawyer that I was mentally ill, like anyone really needed to know that. Don't you hate it when celebrities just blah, 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 talk about themselves? I mean, who asked? I just find it all so wearying. Anyway, where was I? So, having waited my entire life to get an award for something, you know, anything. Fine, okay, not acting, but what about a tiny little award for writing? No. I now get awards all the time for being mentally ill. I'm apparently very good at it, and I am honored for it regularly. Probably one of the reasons I'm such a shoe-in is there's no swimsuit portion of the competition. Well, it's better than being bad at being mentally ill, right? I mean, how tragic would it be to be runner-up for Bipolar Woman of the Year? The first time I did drugs was when I was 13. Before we lost all our money, my family had a vacation house in Palm Springs, about 2 hours outside of Beverly Hills, where I ostensibly grew up. So, periodically, my mother used to rent that house in Palm Springs to these people who, after one of their stays, left behind a bag of marijuana. Who knows? Maybe they left it intentionally, you know, a kind of chemical sacrifice on the altar of appreciation for their time there. Anyway, after my mother found the pot, she came to me and said, "Dear, I thought instead of your going outside and smoking pot where you might get caught and get in trouble, I thought you and I might experiment with it together." Well, frankly, at the time, and let's face it, even now, I couldn't imagine anything weirder. But what actually came to pass was that after presenting this bizarre, albeit marginally appealing proposal, my mother got swept back up into the whirlwind of her life and promptly forgot about it. But being the crafty, eager for the altered state person I was destined to become, I absolutely did not. So once it became obvious that our proposed experiment had slipped my mother's mind, I snuck into the lab of her sachet underwear drawer and stole the pot, subsequently experimenting my brains out in my backyard treehouse with my friend May, who coincidentally also ended up in AA. And you've got to figure that I enjoyed it because I ended up experimenting with marijuana for the next 6 years until it suddenly, and I think rather rudely, turned on me. Where at the onset it was all giggles and munchies and floating in a friendly haze, it suddenly became creepy and dark and scary. What was a junkie to do? Well, the answer was quite obvious. I needed to find a new replacement drug. This was when I was about 19, while I was filming Star Wars. It ultimately turned out to be Harrison's pot that did me in. So after carefully casting about for a substitute substance, I finally settled into my new drug digs. Hallucinogens and opiates. Mind expanders and painkillers. Though over time and protracted use, their meanings got jumbled until they became mind relievers and pain expanders. A place where everything hurt and nothing made sense. Anyway, at a certain point in my early 20s, my mother started to become worried about my obviously ever-increasing drug ingestion. So she ended up doing what any concerned parent would do. She called Cary Grant. In case you haven't heard, one of the many things Mr. Grant was known for at the time was the fact that at some point in the 60s, he famously did a course of LSD while under a doctor's supervision. It's always been difficult for me to imagine this. Do they actually drop the acid in the doctor's office? Does the doctor do it too? I always thought there was a kind of strange dignity and an even stranger credibility given to acid done under the cool shade of medical supervision. Sometimes, when I heard the phrase experimenting with drugs, I imagined someone in a white coat excitedly emerging from a lab carrying a smoking beaker and shouting, "I found it! I found it!" But when I heard that Cary Grant had experimented with acid under the supervision of his doctor, well, in a way, it was as if he was dedicating his hallucinogenic jaunt to modern science. I imagine him doing it a little reluctantly and with a quiet dignity. After, of course, washing his hands and putting on one of those little backless hospital garbs 10 minutes before the medicinal acid kicked in. Anyway, my concerned and caring mother called Cary Grant and told him that her daughter had a problem with acid. You know, like I was mainlining the stuff. You have to admit, though, on a certain level, it was an incredibly darling thing for her to do, especially when you consider the fact that I loved Cary Grant. I still do, only now at more of a distance. He's probably the only famous person I was ever really in awe of. Having 2 celebrity parents and a few celebrity boyfriends, it was extremely rare for me to get starstruck. Not that I was blasé about famous people, I just wasn't bowled over and tongue-tied and staring, as if I'd just undergone more electric shock therapy or stuck my finger in a socket. But Cary Grant, well, he just killed me. I mean, I was completely blown away by him. He had it all. An easygoing class, quiet confidence, wit, all in this beyond handsome package. So when the phone rang and a familiar voice informed me that he was Cary Grant, even a Cary Grant that was going to maybe give me a just-say-no drug lecture, well, initially I was, in fact, totally tongue-tied. Normally, I wouldn't have believed that the person on the other end really was Cary Grant. But when he told me my mother had asked him to call, well, that sounded eerily like some bizarre thing my mother would do. In a way, there was actually a precedent for this Cary Grant intervention call. Some years prior, I was in London en route to my mother's wedding. I don't like to miss any of my parents' weddings. She called me at the hotel where I was staying, and when I didn't answer the phone, she became understandably concerned. So she let the phone ring and ring and ring until finally she panicked. She knew I was in the room, so in her mind, probably the only reason I wasn't answering the phone was that I had overdosed. So she did what any normal, concerned mother might do when troubled about her daughter's well-being. She called Ava Gardner. And she asks Ava to come to my hotel and get the concierge to let her in my room to make sure I'm not dead. Anyway, the reason this relates to Cary Grant, if it isn't obvious, is that the Ava Gardner Rescue Squad, good title for a rock band, is the reason that I would even begin to believe that someone telling me that they were Cary Grant might actually, in fact, be Cary Grant. So, initially, when I got on the phone with Mr. Grant, I was incredibly nervous, seeing as how I was on the phone with no less than my fucking hero. But once we began to discuss my acid addiction, after a freakishly short time, I found myself chatting gaily with what might as well have been a Cary Grant impersonator. Because let's face it, there was no actual visual confirmation that this was, in fact, Cary Grant. So I think I finally convinced him that, despite my mother's insistence, I didn't have an acid problem, which, for the most part, was true. What I did have was an opiate problem, but frankly, that was none of Cary Grant's fucking business, no matter how much I admired him. Anyway, though we chatted for about an hour or so, I have basically no memory of what we discussed. Oh yeah, there was one thing. Chevy Chase and how he had insinuated on some talk show that Mr. Grant was bisexual. Now, as it happened, I was working on a film with Chevy at that time. A marvelous film called Under the Rainbow, a riveting film about the making of The Wizard of Oz, starring Chevy, me, Eve Arden, and 3,000 dwarves. And Chevy and I were getting along somewhat less than a house on fire. So on top of our LSD chat, we had that in common. Poor Chevy Chase relations. So, when our hour-long chat was up, I bid Mr. Grant a grateful goodbye, gleefully told all my friends, and end of story. Now, I thought, I had a Cary Grant story to tell my children and grandchildren for years to come, right? Well, as it turned out, actually no, not right. Because my Cary Grant story continued, and this time from an unexpected direction. A few years later, my father went to Princess Grace's funeral in Monaco. Please ask me if he actually knew the princess. Of course he didn't. My father had never even met the woman, either prior to her ascent to the throne when she was just plain old Grace Kelly, the Oscar-winning movie star, or after she became Monaco's very own Royal Highness. But I learned that you don't actually have to know the person whose funeral you're attending. In fact, sometimes, depending on the person, it's better that way. But my father had his own reasons for going to the funeral of this very famous, beautiful woman. Publicity. So there's my father wandering around aimlessly at this far-flung funeral of a famous woman, one of the few beautiful women of his generation that he hadn't slept with, schmoozing with thousands of other mourners, trying to make eye contact with someone who he could grieve with and maybe generate a photo op in the process, when he spies Cary Grant. And something clicked in his brain, and that something turned out to be the dim recollection of a story he'd only just recently been told. What was it again? Oh, yeah, something to do with his firstborn daughter. By now, he's walked up to my hero, and he says the first thing that pops into his head, which is something along the lines of, "My daughter Carrie is addicted to acid, and I'm very worried about her. Would you mind maybe having a talk with her?" Great. I've now gone from having an acid problem straight to a full-on LSD addiction, as if such a thing were possible. I'm mainlining the stuff. So, here we go again. Poor Cary Grant, and I'm sure he's very rarely been called that, gets back from the funeral and in due course calls me again to discuss my issue with slamming acid. Well, if I was embarrassed the first time he called me, this time I was completely humiliated. I explained to Mr. Grant, after thanking him profusely for taking the time out to counsel me on my alleged dependence on hallucinogens, that in fact, I didn't spend all that much time with my father, the time required to be able to accurately ascertain as to whether or not I had any sort of a problem, much less a drug one. I suggest to Mr. Grant that my mother would probably be in a much better position to determine whether or not I was tripping my brains out on a daily basis than my father, who I spent, on an average, one day a year with. So Mr. Grant says, "Well, it was very nice of your father to express his concern. It's very difficult to maintain a relationship with a child after the mother and father have divorced. I have a daughter myself, and I see her as much as I can, but when a child divides her time between two houses, no matter how you try, it's impossible to spend as much time with your child as you'd like to." So perhaps my father's motive hadn't been solely to find a subject matter to talk to Cary Grant about at the photo op funeral. Mr. Grant didn't seem to think so. So maybe this was another example of nothing ever being just one thing. No motive is pure, no one good or bad, but a hearty mix of both. And sometimes life actually gives to you by taking away. Anyway, Mr. Grant and I stay on the phone for over an hour talking about this and that, how he wishes he could be a more involved parent, you know, the usual shooting the shit with Cary Grant type thing. It was great. The phone call eventually comes to a close, and I immediately go to the liquor store and buy him a bottle of wine from his birth year, which is something like 1907. And now he calls me again to thank me. And in that final phone call, I believe he told me, I don't even like wine. I mean, we're ultimately talking about no less than 3 phone calls from Cary Grant. The guy was practically stalking me. Anyway, cut to a few months later, and I'm at this premiere or charity event or something. And I turn, and there, just a few feet away from me, actually in the flesh, as far in as you could get, is Cary Grant. Big as life and twice as famous. But this time, it's not just some disembodied voice that sounds a lot like Cary Grant. No, this is the real deal. Classy and handsome, and just about everything a human can possibly be when they're a DNA jackpot. But am I intimidated? Oh my God, yes. So, with my heart pounding in my ears and my nose and my hair, I sheepishly approach my ideal and very timidly tap him on the back, withdrawing my hand immediately as if I burned my finger on his radioactive, sizzling hot, iconic back. Whereupon Cary Grant turns, and I immediately start backing away from him as though one of us was contaminated. Hi, I'm Debbie Reynolds' daughter, I admit as though this was a crime. We talked on the phone. I'm stooped over like someone frightened and ashamed. Anyway, no big deal. I don't want to bother you. I just wanted to say hi. Oh, hello. Yes. How are you? I'm still backing up, forcing him to follow me. Oh, I'm fine, I whisper. Everything is great. It's so good to see you. Bye. And I fled the scene of this social crime, never to return. Years later, while I was in Australia doing some terrible film, they announced on the radio that Cary Grant had passed away. And I remember getting this pain, the kind you get when you experience a body blow or lose something essential. Who would talk me out of slamming LSD now? So I think to myself, after all this, you know, after all the nightclubs and the gay husband and the rehabs, one of my fellow inmates in the last rehab I was in was Ozzy Osbourne. That went well. So after all the rehabs and all the mental hospitals, I think to myself, if what doesn't kill you makes you, well, what doesn't kill you makes you not dead. But if what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I should be able to lift Cedars-Sinai Hospital and glow in the dark. So I say to myself at this point, bring it on! Don't ever say that, because it will be brought. 'Cause that's when my friend Greg died. The newly made bystander. I didn't realize I actually had post-traumatic stress disorder at the time, but why would I think I had that? Anyway, how would I know which was post-traumatic stress, which is addiction, which is bipolar, which is Libra? Also, I thought you had to go to Iraq to get post-traumatic stress disorder. And you do. But you can also just come on over to my house. Anyway, a few months later, I guess my friends were getting worried about me because, you know, I wasn't talking and most people know I'm essentially voice activated. And I was smoking like it was food. So finally, I agreed to go to this grief counselor they found for me. And my favorite thing that this woman said to me was, I'm so sorry we had to meet under these conditions. Hello, you're a grief counselor. What other conditions would we meet under? Then she says, I can't even imagine what you've been through. You can't? Well, if you can't, then I'm really fucked. Anyway, a couple weeks after this, my daughter Billy, who's about 13 at the time, tells me that when she grows up, she wants to be a neurologist with a specialty in schizophrenia. So I say, why not be a grief counselor? We'll see each other more. My daughter, Billy, is incredible. even though she's a teenage girl, and they so often end up thinking their mothers are lame and or insane. And in Billy's case, she's obviously not completely wrong. She's so pretty, though. She looks a lot like my mother. And she's a straight-A student, except for chemistry, and when's that going to come up? And she's a great writer, and she has this wonderful singing voice. Where'd she get that? Oh, and she just got a driver's license, so pray for me. Anyway, once, when Billy was about 4, we were driving along in Florida. And she sees this church, and she points to it, and she says, "Mommy, what's that?" And I said, "Well, baby, that's where people go to worship God." And she said, "God, like the God bless you God?" Like that's his main claim to fame. I took a job at one point when Billy was about 3 or 4 with a magazine who would send me to different places with her and one of her friends, and then I would write about it. I wanted to call it Billy's Holiday, but they ended up cleverly calling it Travels with Billy. So we got to go to all sorts of places. One time we went to Vegas and visited my mother's hotel, where there were actually slot machines that in order to win, you had to get 3 faces in a line of my mother's smiling face. But no matter how many times I tried to get a jackpot with my mother's head, I never seemed able to win. I couldn't hit the jackpot with my mother's smiling face. Now, if I dreamt that, a shrink would have a field day analyzing its deeper meaning. Billy has always been a very verbal and watchful child. And, you know, what's terrible nowadays is that you can get everything on TV and the Internet. You know, you get movies that are rated PG or PG-13, but it's not a system that accurately indicates just how sophisticated or explicit these films are. Anyway, one day Billy and I were watching Muriel's Wedding, and I was thinking, well, this is okay, right? I mean, why shouldn't she see this? I didn't remember it as anything inappropriate. So I'm sitting there with her, and suddenly one of the girls in the movie says, "She sucked your husband's cock." And then another woman responds, "Oh, well, she also sucked your husband's cock." So I'm sitting there next to Billy, and I'm devastated. What do I say, if anything? She's about 7 at the time. So I say, "You don't think people actually do that, do you?" "Great, there's a brilliant point." And she looks sheepish and says, "No." Then, about 6 months later, we're watching yet another one of these movies that I think is totally fine when it happens again. Another actress makes a reference to going down on a man. So I say to Billy one more time, "You don't think people actually do that, do you?" I don't know what she's been exposed to between the Internet and school, no matter how diligently I try to monitor it. This time she responds very quietly, "Yes." I'm totally unprepared for this, so I say, "Well, you don't think men actually like it, do you?" And to this she emphatically shakes her head no. So you can see how great I am insofar as it relates to training my daughter. I did tell her about the birds and the bees, but you kind of have to move really fast because of what kids are exposed to now. The weird thing is that when kids see porn before they have sex and... ooh. Well, actually, I'm a fine one to talk because when I was 15, I was in the chorus of my mother's show, like most teenagers, and the gay guys in the show showed me a movie called 16 Inches in Omaha to either shock me or watch my reaction. As you can imagine, this is a wonderful introduction to the male anatomy, so subtle and nuanced. Anyway, more recently, Billy told me, now she's changed her mind. She no longer wants to be a neurologist with a specialty in schizophrenia. Now she wants to be a comic, which, if you think about it, is a kind of natural progression. So I say, well, baby, if you want to be a comic, you got to be a writer. But don't worry, you've got tons of material. Your mother's a manic depressive drug addict, your father's gay, your grandmother tap dances, and your grandfather shot speed. And my daughter laughs and laughs and laughs. And I say, baby, the fact that you know that's funny is gonna save your whole life. Location, location, location. Now, if you had a daughter that great, you don't, but if you did, wouldn't you want to do something really nice for her? Right? Well, I did. I wanted her to have some, like, normal mommy memories of me, you know? Like, not just memories of a mother who got tattoos or hid Easter eggs in July. So what I did was I learned to cook. And it turns out I'm a pretty good cook. I mean, I make most of my meals at about 11 o'clock at night, but they're very, very delicious. Anyway, when I first learned to cook, my mother flipped out. It was like I was violating a family code or ethic or credo. I didn't even know we had those things. She would say, "Carrie's in the kitchen, cooking." You know, like she was saying, shaving her head. And what a weird thing to do in the kitchen, by the way. So one night I'm at her house. I told you we live next door to each other. And I say, "Oh, I'm going to go back up to my house and make Billy dinner." She grabs my arm and she says, "No! Why are you doing this? Please let me send Mary to make her chicken crepes." But I'm pleased to report that over time, my mother has become more accustomed to my cooking, so that now she says, "You know, dear, we had an Uncle Wally in the family that was a good cook." So if she can recognize it as a talent, especially one from her side of the family, she's cool with it. I heard someone once say that many of us only seem able to find heaven by backing away from hell. And while the place that I've arrived at in my life may not be precisely everyone's idea of heavenly, I could swear sometimes if I'm quiet enough, I can hear the angels sing. Either that or I've screwed up my medication. But one of the reasons I think my life is going so much better is that having originally done Wishful Drinking, the show, and now the book, as a singles ad, you know, like a really, really detailed personals ad, I think if I attract someone from one of my audiences or one of the readers of this book, he'll never be able to say, "You never told me you were a manic depressive drug addict that turned men bald and gay," like men say to me now. 'Cause I'm no different than any other single person. I also want someone to love and treasure and overwhelm. Ooh, and disappoint, especially disappoint. I find that so erotic. Anyway, the ad worked. Because when I did my show in Santa Fe, I received in the mail a marriage proposal. How great is that? Now, I told you I was manic depressive, right? So you know I have lousy judgment. So I was hoping that before I take such an enormous step, I could run the proposal past you and get you to somehow weigh in on it, okay? Keep in mind, I'm not getting any younger. "Dearest Carrie Fisher, I want a relationship with you because I want to get married and have sex every night." Oh, 'cause that's what you do when you're married. "You are older than me, but I am a full-grown man of 41. I do love you, Carrie. Here are the most personal things about me. I have a big tummy, and I had an anus operation for hardened hemorrhoid bleeding." Well, which is good to know, because now I can never say to him, "You never told me you had an anus operation for hardened hemorrhoid bleeding," like I would. "I used to buy VHS videos for self-gratification since I was 15 to a couple years ago. I have had sex before, and I'm not a virgin since I was 14. I never had a girlfriend or been married because I was seeking stardom for myself until fall of 1982. Because you all remember what happened in fall of 1982. I love the band Duran Duran and the movie